This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Matchmaking for Beginners by Maddie Dawson. Performed by Amy McFadden and Joyce Bean.
One. Blix. I shouldn't have come, and that's the truth of it. It's not even 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm already fantasizing about a swift, painless coma. Something dramatic, involving a nice collapse to the floor, with my eyes rolling back in their sockets and my limbs shaken. It's my niece's annual post-Christmas tea, you see, when people who are barely crawling out from underneath weeks of holiday shopping, parties, and hangovers find themselves required by Wendy Spinnaker to don their red sweaters and pleated slacks one more time and go stand for hours in her living room so they can admire her expensive Christmas decorations and her refurbished mansion and drink a ridiculous red cocktail that a high school student in a waitress uniform delivers on a tray. As near as I can tell, the purpose of this gathering is simply so my niece can remind the good people of Fairlane, Virginia, that she is a very important person, and wealthy besides, a force to be reckoned with, a giver to charity, a chairwoman of most things. I can't keep track of it all, to tell you the truth. I'm tempted to stand up and ask for a show of hands. How many of y'all have souls that have withered in just the last few hours? How many would like to join me in a conga line right out the front door? I know I'd have some takers. My niece would also have me murdered in my bed. I live far away, and I'm old as dirt, so I wouldn't have even come to this thing. Most years I have enough sense to avoid it. But Houndy said I had to. He said I'd regret not seeing the family for the last time if I didn't. Houndy worries about things like deathbed regrets. I think he imagines the end of life like the finish of a satisfying novel, something that should be wrapped up with a nice bow, all the sins forgiven. Like that would ever happen. I'll go, I said to him finally, but I am not telling them I'm sick. They'll know when they look at you, he said. And then, of course, they didn't. Worse, this year would be the time when my grandnephew Noah has just gotten himself engaged, and so the party has stretched on into infinity because we're all waiting for him and his fiancée to arrive from California so she can be shown the high society she is marrying into. She's just some flibbertigibbet he met at a conference, and somehow she figured out how to snag him, Wendy told me over the phone. Probably doesn't have a functioning brain cell in her head. A nursery school aide, if you can stand it. Family isn't anybody to speak of. The father's in insurance, and the mother doesn't do anything for anybody as near as I can tell. They're from Florida. That's how she says it, Florida. I was still processing the word flibbertigibbet and wondering what that might mean in Wendy's universe. No doubt I'd be described as something equally dismissive. I'm still considered the family misfit, you see, the one who has to be carefully watched. Blix, the outrage. They hate that I took my inheritance and moved to Brooklyn, which anyone knows is unacceptable, populated as it is by northerners. I look around this room in the house that was once our family homestead, passed down through the generations from favorite daughter to favorite daughter. Missing me, of course. And it takes everything I can muster to block all the negative energy that slithers along the baseboards. The 10-foot-tall artificial Christmas tree, with its glass Christopher Radko ornaments and the twinkling fairy lights, is trying to insist that everything here is just dandy, thank you very much. But I know better. This is a family that is rotten at its core, no matter what the decor tells you. I see things as they are, right through the fakery and pretense. I can still remember when this place really was authentically grand, before Wendy Spinnaker decided to throw thousands of dollars into some kind of fake restoration of its facade. But that sums up this family's philosophy of life perfectly. Plaster over the real stuff, and slap a veneer on the top. Nobody will know. But I know. A slightly drunk old gentleman with bad breath comes over and starts telling me about bank mergers he's merged and some acquisitions he's acquired, and also that he thinks my niece is the only person who can make Welsh rarebit taste like a potload of old socks. I'm about to agree with him when I realize with a start that he didn't really say that last bit. It's too loud and hot in this room, so I vaporize him with my mind. And sure enough, he toddles off. I have my talents. Then, miracle of miracles, just as we're all about to succumb to despair and heavy drinking, the front door opens with a whoosh, and the party suddenly takes on energy, like somebody plugged it back in, and we're allowed to come to life. The young couple is here. Wendy hurries over to the entryway and claps her hands and says, "Everyone, everyone, of course y'all know my darling, brilliant Noah. And now this is his lovely fiancée, Marnie McGraw, soon to be our exquisite daughter-in-law. Welcome to you, darling." The little quartet in the corner of the living room strikes up "Here Comes the Bride," and everyone flocks around, shaking hands with the couple, blocking my view. I can hear Noah, heir to the family's bluster and bravado, booming as he talks about the flight and the traffic, while his fiancée is being manhandled and hugged as though she's a commodity who now belongs to everybody. If I crane my neck over to the right, I can see that she's truly lovely. Tall and thin, red-cheeked and golden, and wearing a blue beret tipped askew with a jauntiness you don't normally see at Wendy's parties. And then I notice something else about her, too. Something about the way she peeks out from under her long blonde bangs. And pow, from across the room, her eyes meet mine, and I swear something passes in a flash from her to me. I had been about to get up from my place on the love seat, but now I fall back into it, close my eyes, and squeeze my fingers. I know her. Oh, my God, I actually feel like I know her. It takes me a minute to regroup. Maybe I'm mistaken after all. How could it be? But no, it's true. Marnie McGraw is just like the old, glorious me, standing there, facing this onslaught of southern gentility, and I see her both young and old, and feel my own old heart pounding like it used to. "Come over here, sweetheart," I beam toward her. "So this is why I'm here. It wasn't to give some closure to years of family strife. It wasn't to drink these absurd cocktails or even to revisit my roots. I was meant to meet Marnie McGraw." I put my hand against my abdomen, against the ball of tumor that's been growing there since last winter, the hard, solid mass that I already know is going to kill me outright before summer comes. "Come over here, Marnie McGraw. I have so much I need to tell you." Not yet. Not yet. She does not come. "Ah, yes, of course. There are duties to be performed when you're being shown off to polite southern society, when you're the heir apparent's intended." And under the strain of it all, Marnie McGraw has turned fluttery, nervous. And then she makes a dreadful faux pas. One that's so delightfully horrendous, it alone would have stood her in good stead with me for a lifetime, even if I didn't already know her. She declines to take a portion of Wendy's Welsh rarebit. At first, she simply shakes her head politely when it is thrust in her direction. She tries to claim she isn't hungry, but that's clearly untrue, as Wendy points out with her laser-like eyes flashing, because Marnie's been traveling with Noah for hours, and Wendy happens to know that they missed both breakfast and lunch and have tried to survive on airline peanuts.
"Why, honey, you must eat," Wendy exclaims.
You don't have a single extra calorie on those bones, bless your heart. I close my eyes. She's been here only a few minutes and has already earned herself a deadly bless your heart. Marnie, wobbly now, reaches out and takes a scone and a single red grape, but this is not the right thing either.
No, no, my dear, have some rabbit, urges Wendy.
I know the edge in the voice. Somehow Noah has failed to explain to his true love that family law here requires that guests take some of the rarebit, and then they must practically fall to the ground writhing in their rapture over its wonderfulness, always so much more wonderful than last year. And then Marnie says the thing that seals her fate. She stammers out the words,
I'm so sorry, but I'm really not comfortable with eating rabbits.
I put my hand over my mouth so people can't see how hard I am smiling. Aha! My niece's eyes flash, and she laughs her brittle, scary laugh and says in a loud voice that makes everyone stop and look,
My dear, wherever did you get the notion that rarebit has anything to do with rabbits? For heaven's sake, is it because they both start with R? Please don't tell me that's what you think. I'm sorry, I didn't. Oh, I'm so sorry.
But that is that. What's done is done. The dish is withdrawn, and Wendy sweeps away, shaking her head. People turn back to their conversations. Wendy the wronged. Kids today, no manners at all. And where is Noah, Marnie's savior and protector during this little scene? I crane my neck to see. Ah, yes, he's gone off with Simon Whipple, his best friend, of course. I see him laughing at something Whipple is saying in the adjacent pool room, two colts stamping their hooves in delight over some incomprehensible, meaningless joke. So I get to my feet and go fetch her. Marnie has two bright spots of color on her cheeks, and without the beret now, her blonde hair is loose and possibly the slightest bit tangled, and might have already been deemed beyond redemption by Wendy. Beach hair, not society hair. Definitely not hair that the movers and shakers of Fairlane, Virginia should have to see at their annual post-Christmas tea. I bring her over to where I had camped out, and I pat the love seat next to me, and she sits down, pressing her fingertips into her temples.
I'm so sorry, she says. I'm such an idiot, aren't I?
Please, I say. No more apologies, my love. I can see in her eyes that it's dawning on her precisely how many things she's already done wrong. Not counting the rarebit, she's also wearing the wrong kind of clothing for this little soiree. Black skinny pants, a tunic top. In the sea of the de rigueur red cashmere sweaters and coiffed sprayed hairdos and Santa Claus earrings, Marnie McGraw, with her lanky, bangs-in-the-eyes, tangled yellow hair, dares to wear a gray shirt, without even one sparkly piece of jewelry to acknowledge that Christmas is the holiest of holidays and the post-Christmas tea is the best part of Christmas. And her shoes, turquoise leather cowboy boots. Fantastic, of course, but not high society boots. I take her hand in mine to soothe her, and also to surreptitiously check her lifeline. When you're an old woman, you can reach over and touch people since you're harmless and invisible most of the time. Pay no attention to Wendy, I whisper to her. She missed the class on manners because she was attending two extra courses on personal intimidation. Marnie looks down at her hands.
No, I was the awful one. I should have just taken the rarebit.
The fuck you were, I whisper back, and that makes her laugh. People find it hilarious when an old woman says fuck. It must break every law of nature when we swear. You were trying to politely decline eating a cute furry animal and got embarrassed for your trouble. She looks at me.
But it's not made of rabbits, I guess.
Well, it sounds like it is. Some people still call it Welsh rabbit. And what? You're supposed to research all the dishes of Northern Europe in preparation for coming to a Christmas tea? Give me a break.
I should have known.
Look, whose side are you on? Yours or Our Lady of the Hoity-Toity Mansion?
What?
I pat her hand. You're delightful, I say. And the truth is that my niece is a bit of a stick. In fact, look around at this whole crowd. Normally, I don't like to bring down the forces of evil on myself by being critical, but just look at all the fake smiles and sour faces around here. I'm going to have to take a bath with a wire brush to get all this negativity off me when I leave. And I suggest you do the same. Bunch of damn hypocrites eating the Welsh rarebit whether they like it or not. And you know what else?
What?
I lean toward her and stage whisper. It could be made of Welsh rabbit turds and they would still eat it, because Wendy Spinnaker is their overlord and leader. She laughs. I love her laugh. We sit in a companionable silence. To anyone else's eye, we're nothing more than two strangers who find themselves making polite small talk because they'll soon be related. But I am bursting with the need to tell her everything. Of course, I begin badly because I am so out of practice when it comes to small talk. So tell me about you, I say in a rush. Are you doing everything you want as an unmarried person before you hook your life up to this guy's life? She raises her eyebrows slightly.
Well, yes, I have a good job, and I've done stuff, gone places. You know, I'm nearly 30, so it's time I got ready to be a real adult. Somebody who has settled down.
Settled down. That sounds god-awful, doesn't it?
I think it sounds rather nice. I mean, if you're in love with the person, then it's a good thing that you get to stop all the running around and make a home together.
She looks around the room, probably searching for anything else we could talk about, and then her eyes land back on me.
By the way, I love what you're wearing tonight.
What I'm wearing is a purple velvet vintage evening gown that I bought at a thrift shop in Brooklyn. It has little glass beads sewn in circles all over it, and it shows actual, certifiable, measurable cleavage. Not that my cleavage is anything great. Truthfully, it looks like a sack of peach pits. It's my showstopper dress, I tell her. And then I lean over and whisper, I am ridiculously proud of the girls tonight. The fact is, I had to tie them up in this wired-up bra to get them to stand up enough for this, but I figured they could give me a last hurrah. After this, no more bras ever. I promise them.
I love the colors. I didn't know what to wear, so I put on this gray shirt that I thought would go with anything, but it looks so boring compared to everybody else.
She leans over and laughs.
I do not think I've ever seen so many red sweaters in one room.
It's the Christmas uniform here in Fairlane, Virginia. I'm surprised they didn't issue you one at the town line. Just then, a high school student bearing a tray of drinks comes by, and Marnie and I both select a red concoction. It's my fourth, but who's counting? I clink my glass into hers, and she smiles. I can't stop looking at her eyes, which seem so much like my own that it's disconcerting. My hairline is tingling just a little.
So, I say, when you get married, do you think you'll get to keep on being your wonderful free spirit self?
Her eyes widen.
My free spirit self? She says and laughs. No, no, no. You've got me all wrong. I'm actually looking forward to settling down, buying a house, having kids.
She smiles.
I think a person needs to have a life plan.
I take a moment, sigh a bit, and reach into my neckline to give the girls a gentle readjustment. Maybe that's where I went wrong. I don't think I ever followed a life plan for even 1 minute. Tell me this. Is it worth giving up your own free spirit for?
A life plan is just security, commitment.
Ah, I say, that stuff. Now I see why I didn't go in for it. Anytime anybody mentions security, like it's a good thing, I get the willies. And commitment? Ugh.
Huh. Well, did you ever get married?
Oh, God, yes, twice. Almost three times, actually. First time was to a professor with the illustrious name of Wallace Eldberry, if you please. I bend over closer to Marnie and put my hand on hers and smile. He spent his one wild, precious life on Earth researching the life cycle of a certain kind of green-headed insect, and we traveled to Africa and collected specimens of hard-shelled things so bizarre you wouldn't even want to think about them for longer than 20 seconds. Can you imagine? And when we got home, I realized I'd had enough of bugs to last me my whole life. I dropped my voice to a whisper. And if you want to know the truth of it, Wallace Elderberry himself was starting to look like a big cockroach to me. So we got a divorce.
Wow. Husband turned into a cockroach. Sounds like Kafka.
God, don't you just love it when people manage to bring up Kafka in a routine post-Christmas conversation?
Well, you started it, she says. What happened to the second husband? What did he turn into?
The second time I got married against my better judgment, which you should never ever do, by the way, just in case you're contemplating it.
I'm not, she says.
Of course you're not, but it's an easy mistake a lot of people make. Anyway, that marriage was to Rufus Halloran, a legal aid lawyer, and we set up shop in Brooklyn in a little storefront office in the 1970s. Brooklyn was a mess then. So we did a lot of work for runaways and homeless people. That sort of thing.
And what happened? Did he turn into a cockroach too?
No. He didn't have the imagination to turn into anything, I'm afraid. He turned out to be a horribly boring human who only saw the dark side of everything. I'd look over at him, and it was as though there was a gray haze around him that I couldn't penetrate. All the well-meaningness in the world, but nothing coming off him. No genuine pleasure. Just walls of boring, long-winded words. So, divorce had to happen.
Seriously?
She tilts her head, smiling as she considers this.
You divorced a man because he was boring? I didn't know that was legal grounds.
I had to. It was killing me how boring he was. It was like he had died before his life ended and he was going to take me down with him.
Yeah, but life can't be fascinating all the time.
Oh, honey, mine is. If it gets boring for longer than 2 weeks, I make adjustments. I smile right into her eyes. And it's paid off, because now I live with Houndy, who is a lobsterman. And the thing about him is that he could talk to me for 4 days straight without stopping about lobsters and their shells and the different tides and the sky, and nothing he ever said would bore me, because the language that Houndy is really speaking in is all about love and life and death and appreciation and gratitude and funny moments. Her eyes flicker, and I see in her face that she knows exactly what I mean.
I feel like that when I'm at work, she says softly. I work in a nursery school, so I get to spend my day sitting on the floor with 3- and 4-year-olds talking. People think it must be the most boring thing in the world, but oh my God, they tell me about the most astonishing things. They get into philosophical discussions about their boo-boos and about how worms on the sidewalk get their feelings hurt sometimes, and why the yellow crayon is the meanest one, but the purple one is nice. Can you believe it? They know the personalities of crayons.
She laughs and sticks her legs out in front of her.
I was telling my dad about this the other day, and he didn't understand it at all. Of course, he thinks I should be doing something a little bit more grown up.
He'd really like it if I was interested in business. She stops, looks embarrassed, and then adds, My dad is actually very nice, but he paid for me to go to a really expensive college, you see, and all I've done is become a teacher's aide. My sister, now she did him proud, became a research chemist, but me, meh. So I told him, Look, Dad, you have one amazing daughter and one ordinary daughter, and one out of two isn't that bad.
Listen, I say, I've been swept off my feet by all this. Come outside with me. I want to get out of here. Do you see how all the negative energy is pooling over there by the piano? See? The air is darker over there. I think we need to go outside and get some real air. She looks uncertain.
Maybe I should find Noah. Where is he?
We both are suddenly aware of the party going on around us, the little knots of people talking to each other, Wendy holding court in the dining room, laughing her brayish laugh. Noah's gone off somewhere with his friend Whipple, I tell her. They're inseparable. She might as well know that about him right now.
Oh, yes, I've heard a lot about Whipple, she says. Maybe I should go talk to them. Reassure Whipple that I'm not going to be the kind of wife who, you know, keeps dude friends away.
I say you should come outside with me. Whipple can wait. Of course, you're the guest of honor here, so we'll have to time our exit just right so nobody decides to stop us. Are you good at sneaking? Just follow me. And for God's sake, don't make eye contact with anyone. I grab her hand and we set off, heads down, scurrying along the back hallway and out through the kitchen. The maids are washing some of the trays, and one of them, Mavis, who I noticed is in love with the UPS guy who came today, calls to me. It's cold out there, Miss Holiday. And I say, We'll come back in for tea soon. And then finally we've made it outside. And the night air is so cold and sharp that we have to take deep breaths. It's wonderful here in the vast expanse of the backyard, a yard that stretches out as far as a golf course, with hedges and a rose garden down to the pond. The yellow light from the party spills out onto the patio, and the garden is lit by dozens of luminaries, white paper bags glowing with electronic candles. The night is so perfect that I'm not surprised when it starts to snow very lightly, as if someone had turned on a switch for our benefit.
Oh, my goodness, Marnie says, holding out her hands. Look at this. I never get to see snow. It's wonderful.
The first snow of the year, I say. Always a crowd pleaser.
Noah told me you grew up here. Do you ever miss it?
No, I say, not when I have Brooklyn. I tell her then about my crazy house and my crazy little community of people, a hodgepodge of kids and parents and old people, everybody coming in and out of each other's apartments and telling their stories and giving each other advice and bossing everybody around. I tell her about Lola, my best friend next door who lost her husband 20 years ago, and about Jessica and her sweet, quirky boy, and how it is with all of them needing love so much, and yet how fearful they are whenever love comes anywhere close. And then, because Marnie needs to know this, I explain that I've got this whole matchmaking thing going on with them, simply because I can't help but see who they need to belong with. I think I will tell her about Patrick, too, but then I stop, because her eyes have widened and she says, You do matchmaking? And bingo, here we are, right where I needed us to land. Yes, I've got this little spidey sense thing going when I see people who need to be together. You have it too, don't you? She stares at me.
How did you know? I've gone around my whole life thinking about this stuff. I'll see two people, and I just know they have to be together, but I don't know how I know. I just know it.
Yes, it's the same for me.
I'm silent, willing her to talk.
My best thing ever was when I found my sister a husband, she says at last. He was my roommate's brother, and I met him when he came to pick up my roommate for Christmas break, and at that very moment, I knew he was going to be right for Natalie. I couldn't think of anything else. It was like my heart hurt until I could introduce them. And then, sure enough, when they met, fireworks. They fell for each other almost immediately. I don't know how I knew, but I did.
Of course you did, I say softly. I look out at the gardens and the trees, so shadowy against the white snowy sky, and I want to fall down in gratitude. Here I am. I'm at the end of my life, and the universe has sent her to me. At last. You have many gifts, I say when I can speak again.
You think that's a gift? The way I see it is that I'm just this person who sits around and thinks, wow, my co-worker Melinda might want to hang out with the guy who teaches soccer in the after-school program, because they kind of match each other. Meanwhile, my sister is inventing things that are going to save the world, and what's taking up space in my brain most days is who in my vicinity looks like they could fall in love. Big deal.
I feel my heart pounding so loudly, I have to squeeze my fingers to ground myself. Please, I say. The subversive truth about love is that it really is the big deal everyone makes it out to be. And it's not some form of security or an insurance policy against loneliness. It's everything, love is. It runs the whole universe.
Well, it's not more important than the work of curing cancer, she says.
Yes, it is. It's the life force. It's all there is, in fact. She hugs herself, and I watch her as snowflakes land gently on her arms.
Sometimes, she says, I see colors around people, and little lights. My family would be horrified if they knew. They'd see it as some kind of neurological condition, I think. But I see little showers of sparks coming from nowhere.
I know. It's just thought energy, I tell her. And then I bite my lip and decide to plunge right in. Do you ever use thoughts to make things happen? Just for fun?
What do you mean?
Well, watch. Turn around and let's look in the window there. See, let's choose the woman in the red sweater. She laughs.
Which one? They all have red sweaters.
The one with the red hair. Let's just beam some thoughts over to her. Send her some white light. Go ahead and watch what happens. We're both silent. I bathe the woman in a glow with white light the way I do, and sure enough, after about 30 seconds, she puts down her drink and looks around the room as though she's heard her name being called. Marnie laughs in delight. See? We did that. We sent her a little hit of something good and she got it, I say.
Wait a minute. That's energy? Does it always work?
Not always. Sometimes you get resistance. I only do it for fun. The matchmaking stuff, that seems to come from somewhere else. It's like I get shown which people should be together. She looks at me with interest. The red spots on her cheeks are glowing brighter.
So did you figure out a way to make a living by being a matchmaker then? That's maybe what I need to figure out.
Ah, honey. I make a living being me. What I've learned is that the same intuition that lets me know which people need to be together also leads me to exactly what I need. Ever since I made up my mind to live the way I wanted to live, I've been provided for.
Wow, she says, and laughs. I'm picturing myself trying to explain that to my dad.
And she grabs my hand.
Hey, will you come to our wedding? I really, really want you to be there.
Of course I will, I tell her. if I'm still around, if I can. And that's when the universe evidently decides that enough is enough, and Noah appears, coming out the back door and striding toward us, like a man on a slightly annoying mission. "I've been looking for you everywhere," he says. "Oh my God, it's snowing out here, and you guys don't even have coats on."
"I don't need one. It's wonderful," says Marnie. "Look how it sparkles in the light. I had no idea it did that."
"It's just flurries," he says, and comes over and puts his arm across her shoulders. He's such a handsome man, I think, with his dark hair and eyes. But it's so sad how he carries around him an aura of cloudy beige. Marnie turns a bright, lovely pink, and she looks at him so fondly, it's like there's a spray of stars all around her. "I've just been having the most delightful conversation with your fiancé," I tell him. "Well, that's great, but we've got to get going," he says, without looking at me. "Good to see you, Aunt Blix, and I'm sorry it's so short, but we've got another party to get to." I'm sure he doesn't remember that he once adored me, that we used to walk in the woods together and stomp in puddles in our rain boots or bare feet, and that one summer we caught fireflies and minnows and then blessed them and let them go. But that was a long time ago, and sometime along the way he seems to have adopted his mother's position that I am not worth bothering about. I'm over it. Really, I am. I had hoped for so much more. But now I'm so used to my family's indifference that I don't even mind the way they roll their eyes when they think I don't notice, and how they're always saying, "Oh, Blix." Marnie links her arm in Noah's and kisses him on the cheek, and tells me, in case I didn't know, that he's the best third-grade teacher there is, and that all the kids in his class and their mothers just love him to death. I look at him and smile. Noah shifts uncomfortably. "Marnie, I'm afraid we really have to go. Traffic is building as we speak." "Of course you do," I say. "I'd get out of this party, too, if I could think of a plausible excuse." His expression stays the same, but she turns and grins at me. "So," he says to her, "I'll go get your coat for you. Is it in the den?"
"I'll get it," she says. But I touch her arm, and when she looks at me, I shake my head just slightly. "Let him go."
And as soon as he's gone, I say, "Listen, I've got to tell you this. You're amazing and powerful, and you're in line for a big, big life. There are lots of surprises in store for you. The universe is going to take you to such heights." She laughs. "Uh-oh. I don't think I really like surprises." "These will be good ones, I'm sure," I say. "This is the important thing. Don't settle for anything you don't want. That's the main thing." I close my eyes. I want to tell her that she is all golden and Noah is all beige, and that there's an unfortunate muddiness in the air when he looks at her. And if I could, if I didn't know that she'd decide I was crazy, I'd tell her that she and I are linked somehow, that I've been looking for her. But now Noah's back with the coat and the purse and the instruction that she needs to go inside and tell his family goodbye. She turns to him.
"Your Aunt Blix says she'll come to the wedding, isn't that great?"
He helps her on with her coat, saying, "Yeah, well, tell my mom to add her to the list." And then he pecks me on the cheek. "Take care of yourself," he says. It's time to go. He strides away in that manly, impatient way, motioning for her to follow. "Here, take this. Some color for you." I pull off my scarf, my favorite one with the blue silk burnouts and the straggly fringe, and I put it around her neck, and she smiles and blows me a kiss. As they go inside, I see her tilt her face up to his, pink and golden and scarlet with love, a shower of sparks. Once they're gone, the air slowly settles down around me. The sparks quiet themselves and burn away, like those 4th of July sparklers once they've used up their fuel and are about to turn back into sharp metal sticks. I close my eyes, feeling suddenly drained and tired. And then I know something I didn't know before, a truth as insistent as anything I have ever felt. Marnie McGraw and Noah are not going to marry. In fact, it's already over.
2. Marnie.
Oh my God, that was an epic fail,
says Noah in the car.
Epic! And Whipple, you freak, could you possibly drive like you're even slightly sober? Like you're not trying to get a DUI? We're hoping to stay alive back here.
Whipple's car, a brand new BMW convertible, does seem to be taking the corners on two wheels, I swear. And he appears to have perfected the art of driving with two fingers of his left hand as he holds a cocktail glass in his right hand, a glass that keeps sloshing red alcohol onto the seats and into the center console. I had automatically gotten into the back seat, and then, to my surprise, Noah had jumped in beside me, leaving Whipple alone in the front, which means he has to crane his neck around backward so he can keep up with the conversation. And every time he moves his head, the car swerves off course, and he mashes his foot even harder on the gas pedal.
Oh, so much of tonight has been a disappointment. I do not want to start off married life with mother-in-law problems. My boss, Sylvie, says that's just the worst thing you can do. And now that I'm in the car, I can also hear my mother's voice in my ear. That was so rude of you, to sit there all night talking to one old lady. You should have gone and mingled with all the other guests. That's what that party was for you to meet your fiancé's family and friends. And now this, the biggest disappointment of all. The great Simon Whipple, whom I have heard such fantastic things about, turns out to be nothing more than your standard-issue, red-faced, laughing, overgrown frat boy. And in his presence, Noah seems to be regressing more by the minute. Apparently, we're heading to the home of one of their other friends that Noah says I've got to meet. It's the hometown tour, Noah told me. Meet the freaks. He pulls me over to him, roughly, and starts sucking on my neck like he's going to give me a hickey. Like he thinks we're in high school, just because we're in the back seat.
Holy shit, I am so, so sorry for what I did to you back there,
he says in my ear, way too loudly.
Leaving you in the clutches of my Aunt Blix?
You owe her big time, says Whipple.
Right? She's like the old woman in the forest who eats children.
That's because she's a witch, says Whipple.
Marnie, you're lucky there's anything left of you. I told him, dude, you gotta go get your girlfriend, man. Between your mom and your great aunt, she's gonna run for the hills.
Not this one, says Noah.
I've got this one in the bag.
I pull away from him. His beard is scratching me, and his breath smells like a brewery. I finger the scarf she gave me. It's amazing, with lots of shades of blue and holes that look like they were burned out on purpose. For real, she's a witch, I say, and that makes them both laugh.
No, tell me. Does she, like, practice witchcraft? Is she in a coven or something?
I don't know about a coven, says Whipple, but she totally does spells. Doesn't she, dude?
Spells and potions and all that shit, says Noah.
She's got the whole thing down. It's all over-the-top drama, if you ask me.
She seems really nice, I say. I liked her. Noah leans forward between the seats and takes the drink out of Whipple's right hand and then gulps down the rest of it. Whipple laughs.
Hey, that was mine! I earned that, dude!
I need it more, man. Besides, you're driving.
Tell me, I say, what has she done?
I can't believe you really think she's a witch.
But they have moved on by this time, talking about whether or not some girls they knew in high school are going to be at the party we're all going to. Somebody named Layla is going to shit when she finds out that Noah is engaged without checking with her. I look out the window at all the passing houses, big mansion-type things with huge lawns decorated with white twinkly lights wrapped around the tree trunks and Christmas trees illuminating the windows. Boughs of holly. Fa-la-la-la-la. So genteel. So rich. I wonder if I'll ever really fit in here. Funny, I think later, how you can meet a random handsome guy in California at a party, and he tells you he once wrote movie scripts, and one almost got accepted but then didn't, and he tells you that he's now teaching school, and he loves kids, and he loves to go snowboarding in the mountains in the winter, and later, in bed, after he's managed to do amazing things to you, he tells you just how much he wants to help people in the world, and you can't believe how moved you are at the way his eyes change when he tells you that, how much depth he has, and you find yourself falling in love with these pieces of him that he shows you. And then later, much later, after he's moved in with you and bought you a deluxe garlic press and a pair of amazing turquoise boots and has written a song for you that he plays on his guitar, you go back to his hometown with him and find out that, oh my God, he's the somewhat spoiled son of rich people who let him get away with murder and who don't seem to automatically care about you, except for one ancient aunt no one else seems to like. You see that he contains so many contradictions, and that you will have to make peace, and you will, with these people who are going to be your in-laws, and you will learn to please them. But you also know that after that night, you will look at him completely differently, and that one of the new things you'll know about him is that it's a miracle he survived his childhood and arrived intact at your heart. And yet you still love him to pieces. But in the days that follow your return home, you wonder why he won't answer your questions about his Aunt Blix without rolling his eyes, and why he's slightly disgruntled that you invited her to the wedding without checking with his mom first. He changes the subject, and you change it back, and he sighs and says, "Oh, she didn't get the money she wanted, and so she moved up north and got weird. She looks at everybody like she can see straight through them, down to all the layers of bad stuff." And you say something about how she maybe admires the so-called bad stuff. You make air quotes for this. And he wonders why you're so obsessed with his Aunt Blix, and you say that you're not obsessed. And you're not. But you do wonder why in your spare time, when you're not thinking of anything else, you're having a conversation with Blix in your head. You're wondering if she's right, that love is the true expression of everything in the universe, and if the sparkles you see are real. You're telling her that she's wrong about you, that you're not up for a big life and surprises. You just want ordinary love and happiness with her grandnephew, a house in the suburbs, and three children. And somehow, in a way you can't explain, you know she's not convinced in the least, and that just by knowing her, you're walking into something that's bigger than you are, that might even turn out to be some kind of mystical, crazy thing you're never going to be able to explain to anyone. Like the time you went to the planetarium show, and looking up at the stars that represented billions of light years, you felt like a little point of pulsating light, a flicker in the universe, but something that was meant to exist. And maybe that's why I have a headache. 3. Marnie. 5 months later, after weeks and weeks of wedding preparations, dress buying, invitation writing, venue selecting, all of it mostly orchestrated by my mom and okayed by me via telephone and Skype, I sit in the little room off the side of my parents' hometown church in Jacksonville, Florida, the room where in the normal universe the beautiful bride is to wait with her happy attendants. And I watch while everything in my life falls apart in slow motion. Noah has not shown up for the wedding. He is now 47 and a half minutes late, which, as I keep explaining to anyone who will listen, is still going to be okay. He will come strolling in. He will. He could even send a text message that says something like, "Hey, I'm at the Episcopal Church. Where is everyone?" And then I'll say, "Ha ha ha, wait, not the Episcopal Church. We're getting married at the Methodist Church a block away." And we'll both type in a smiley emoji, and then he'll speed over, and it will all be fine. But so far, nothing like that has happened. So far, what is happening is that I am sweating my head off in this torture chamber with my sister Natalie and my two childhood friends, Ellen and Sophronia. And I am wearing a dress my mother picked out for me, a dress that I now see makes me look like a gigantic white upholstered chair. And my tongue has become this dried-out, fat piece of meat sitting in my mouth, and my hair is pulled so tightly back in a bun that it actually hurts my forehead, and my feet are swelling to twice their normal size, and it is approximately 97,000 degrees in this windowless room, and my sister and my two attendants will mercifully not look at me because they are so embarrassed for me that all they can think to do is stare into their phones until the world ends. From the sanctuary, I hear the organist playing the same three chords over and over again. I wonder how many hours she would go on playing those chords, and how she'll know when to stop. Whose job is it to call off the wedding anyway? Maybe it's like a death, and the minister and my father, and probably me, will all look at our watches, and one of us will say, "Well, this is it. I'm calling it. 4:34. Wedding's not going to happen, folks." Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. Noah is never late to anything unless an airline is involved, and so this means that he's either dead or else he and Whipple are now on their way to some fabulous adventure that girls can't be part of. In which case, I will have to hunt down my supposed-to-be husband and kill him. What if he's dead? What if any moment now a police officer shows up and leads me down to the hospital and I have to stand there in my wedding dress, hysterically weeping while I identify his body? I unpin the veil and start clawing my pulled back hair out of its restraints. "No," says Natalie. "Don't do that." She comes over and sits next to me, her eyes damp and luminous. She is 6 months pregnant. And maybe because she's carrying the future in her body, she is lately a bit hyper-concerned that the world might not turn out to be a predictable, rational place. She always looks like she's about to cry. 2 days ago, she picked me up from the airport when I came in from California for the wedding, and when a Prince song came on the radio, honest to God, she had to pull the car over because she was crying too hard to see. "All because Prince shouldn't have had to die," she said. "There's going to turn out to be a reasonable explanation for this," she says now in a high, wavery voice. "Maybe the bridge is out, or maybe the tuck shop is closed. Text him again." I laugh. "Seriously, Nat? The bridge? The tux shop? Seriously? Text him again." So I do. "Hi, my love monkey. How's it going?" Nothing. "Can't wait to see you. Hashtag married today." Crickets. 5 minutes later, I write, "You up? LOL." Unbeknownst to Natalie, I make a deal with the universe. If I put down my phone and don't look at it while I count to 1,000, then when I pick it up again, he will be typing. The three little dots will be blinking at me, and he'll say he was on his way, but he just had to save somebody's life. Or if there was a hurt dog in the street and he had to find the owner, and he is so, so sorry, but who could leave a dog who was hurt? I count to 848, and then I say, "Forget this," and I write in rapid succession, "WTF, are you okay? Noah Spinnaker, if you don't get here soon, I am going to freak out and probably die. Please, 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 please. Please." My father, all dolled up in his father-of-the-bride tuxedo, peeks in the door.
"How are you holding up, ducky?"
he asks. He hasn't called me that since I was 10 and begged him to stop, so I know he is losing it.
She's coping, okay? Says Natalie. Maybe somebody needs to go and look for this son of a bitch and bring him here.
We're all stunned into silence. I can see my dad thinking, uh-oh, pregnancy hormones. And then he looks at me and says,
Noah's great aunt is out here, and she wants to know if she can have a word with you.
Sure, send her in, I say, swallowing.
And then there's Blix, striding in like she got dressed from the bargain bin at a 1970s clothing consignment shop, but in a good, fun way. She's wearing a long pink tulle skirt and some kind of silvery, shimmery shirt with a bunch of lacy scarves all tied up in loopy knots, long turquoise earrings, and about 100 beaded bracelets. Nothing goes together, and yet somehow she makes it look like an art project. Her crazy white Einstein hair is moussed up into little points, and she's wearing bright red lipstick, and her eyes are extra beady and sharp today. X-ray eyes, Noah calls them, the better to see deep into your soul. I have to admit, I feel a little flicker of hope that maybe she really is a witch. Maybe she's like the fairy godmother in Cinderella, and she'll say bibbidi-bobbidi-boo and conjure Noah up right in front of me. And then my life, which seems to have curled up into the fetal position, will somehow stand up and stretch and crank itself back up into normalcy. Yes, I am precisely that far gone. Ellen, Sophronia, and Natalie look shocked. I raise my hand in a listless wave.
Well, what the actual hell?
Blix says, and we all laugh weakly.
The life force is running out of this room. I've been at funerals that had better vibrations than this.
She puts her hands on her hips and looks around at us, taking in our wedding finery, and for a moment I think she might be about to dispense some fashion advice. Perhaps we need more of something. That's what's gone wrong. Not even one floaty scarf among the four of us. But instead, she comes over and takes my damp hands in her cool bony ones and says, dryly, her eyes shining with trouble and mischief,
I'm not here to make you feel worse. But I just want to tell you that I hope we don't have to kill him today. But if we do, we do. I want you to know I'm up for it. You girls with me?
I see Natalie start to blink very rapidly. I don't think we'll have to kill him, I say quietly, although I had, of course, been thinking the same thing. I wouldn't be surprised if Blix knows that.
Yeah, well, he's pushing his luck.
She says, and pulls up a chair like somebody who's settling in for the duration.
But we've got to take care of you. The important thing is, are you breathing consciously? You're not, are you?
I try to breathe to make her happy.
You know, what we need here is to raise the vibe. We need the breath of joy. It's a yoga thing. I'll show you how to do it.
And to my surprise, she stands up and throws her arms up over her head and then swings them down fast by her sides while she bends her knees and collapses her middle. When her head is almost down to her knees, she lets out a loud, "Argh!" She rights herself and looks at us.
Five times! Fast! Come on, ladies! Yell it out! "Argh! Argh!"
We all do it, except for Natalie. The rest of us are scared not to. Blix claps her hands when we're finished.
Excellent! Excellent! Oh, my God! You young women are so beautiful. You know that? And men are... Well, I like men just fine. But if we're honest, we have to admit that most of them are just smelly, sweaty, grunting ball scratchers. Somehow we're supposed to love them anyway.
She shakes her head.
Gotta love it. Nature's joke. Can't live with 'em. Can't shoot 'em.
And with that, she leans over and plants a soft, dry kiss on my cheek and stares into my eyes. She smells like powder and chai tea and something herbal, possibly marijuana.
I like you, she says,
Take it from me, he's my grandnephew. But like so many men out there, particularly the ones from my family, I'm sorry to say he's not worth a poot. I think now's as good a time as any to ask yourself if you really